I wanted to start by showing you something. This book is a very special book indeed. It's thought to be the very oldest spiritual text written by women in the world, not just in Buddhism, but in the whole world, of any tradition in the world. And 102 women who had all gained enlightenment during the lifetime of the Buddha, they contributed poems about their spiritual experiences, and they were collected together in this book, and there are many others throughout the early Buddhist scriptures as well, contributions of various kinds by women. Some of the poems are very beautiful, some are very profound, some are quite funny as well. For example, there's a section in one of the Buddhist collections called the Samyutta Nikaya, and this is collections of encounters or even clashes between various women and Mara. Mara is the figure who represents doubt and distraction in meditation. Has anybody ever met Mara? So we have to imagine these women doing their meditation, usually out in the forest, sitting under a tree, long retreats they were doing. And in one of these stories, this is the story of a woman called Soma, Mara approaches her while she's meditating, and he tries to put doubts in her mind. And he comes up to her with a big grin on his face, and he says, "What are you doing here?" He's a villain, you know, so you can feel clear. So what are you doing here crying in the forest? He says, "Are you looking for a boyfriend?" But she sees through him at once, and she says, "I know you, time waster. You are Mara." And she says, I'll just read her little poem. She says, "I have finished looking for men. I don't grieve, I don't weep, and I'm not afraid of you, my friend. The mass of darkness is shattered. Having defeated the army of death, free of longing, I dwell." And this is, I said it was Soma, this is Kisa Gotami, actually, who has another very interesting life story, which some of you may have heard. And Mara, hearing her poem, he curses under his breath, and he scuttles away through the leaves. So all you have to do with Mara is to name him, and off he goes. So maybe you could try this next time you're distracted or doubtful in your meditation. Just say, "I know you, it's Mara, I'm not afraid of you." So another Buddhist woman, and this is Soma, was meditating under a tree, and Mara comes up to her, and this is very interesting. He says to her, "Who do you think you are, a woman, thinking you can attain enlightenment? No woman with her two-fingered intelligence can possibly make spiritual progress." Now, apparently, two-fingered intelligence was a little insult, and it meant the ability to check whether the rice is cooked or not by rubbing it between your fingers. So what he's saying is that all you're good for is cooking, you know. I mean, actually, I think that's a pretty difficult thing myself, but still, it's intended as an insult. So she replies, "What difference should a woman's state make when the mind is well concentrated, when knowledge is rolling on, when she rightly has insight into the Dharma? To one for whom the question arises, am I a woman or am I a man in these matters, to such a one is Mara fit to talk?" And once again, curses, he says, and scuttles away, defeated. And in fact, in all of these stories, it's rather one-sided, I'm afraid. In each case, the woman meditator sees through him. And with a little poem that really summarizes the depth of her spiritual experience, she sends him away. So with the first woman, Mara's game was to try to interest her in sex and romance. She was concentrating on meditation. He starts talking about boyfriends, but she would have none of it. The second time, he tries to instill doubt in her about her ability to move towards awakening, towards enlightenment, simply because she is a woman. But she points out that awakening, enlightenment, has nothing to do with gender. So in this talk, I wanted to look a little bit more deeply into sex and gender in traditional Buddhism. And my main motivation for suggesting this topic to Arika was because I wanted to do a little bit of research myself, and I wanted to understand it better. Now, why was I interested in these topics? Well, for one thing, for a long time, and this is the sex side of it, because in a way sex and gender are two separate issues, for a long time I've been puzzled as to why the Buddha encouraged a lot of his disciples to become celibate, which of course involves giving up sex. Are there any advantages in giving up sex altogether? Is there anything about sex that makes it more difficult to practice meditation and to gain wisdom? And as for that issue of gender, that's always interesting, isn't it? And sometimes it seems that men and women are just human beings with slightly different shapes. And I was just kind of looking in the room here, you know, we have this amazing diversity of human beings in this room. And each person is completely different, at least in appearance, and probably deep inside as well. And one of the factors that we tend to sort of look out for when we meet people is gender. But I think an alien coming in and taking, you know, looking at this lot, they'd say, well, they appear to be members of the same species, but their headgear and their T-shirts and their hair is very variable, isn't it? You know, and their size and their shape and all sorts of things. You know. So the issues we face are much the same. What we can achieve is also very similar. So sometimes it just feels, you know, they say we're all members of the same species, that's what it is. But at other times it goes the other way, and it seems there's a great distance between men and women. We seem to see things so differently. We can treat each other very badly at times. And on a large scale, it seems in particular that women have been denied their rightful place in many spiritual traditions. So I was interested to look a little bit more deeply into Buddhism and what it has to say about sexuality, what it has to say about gender. And I don't really have any answers to this. I don't know what is right. I've brought various things out from looking at the tradition and to some extent looking at how Buddhism is practiced today as well, which is also very interesting, I think. But I'd be very, very fascinated to hear your responses, your views and your experience. So I hope that at the end we can do that. There's a lot of us here, so I apologise for that. But at least people, you could make a point if you want to, or ask a question if you want to, or answer a question if you're able to do that. So do bear that in mind. And I'll try and make sure we leave a good chunk of time at the end just to exchange our experiences and our angles on this. So I'll start with the gender issue and look in particular a little bit at women in early Buddhism. Now, Buddhism, of course, originated in India 2,500 years ago, and in ancient traditional India, women were tended to be strongly pushed into their roles as wives and mothers. And in fact, one of the main religious traditions that was gaining ground at that time, Brahmanism, which later developed into what we now call Hinduism, but was not quite that in those days. And that denied any spiritual role at all to women. They weren't even allowed to listen to Brahminical teachings. And men had all the every single role in ancient Brahmanism. But this was not the only contender in India. Some things were changing. Many people were questioning the old ideas. Many people were questioning the Brahminical ideas. And some of them left their homes to become what in Greece were known as wandering philosophers. I like that idea, you know, a wandering philosopher who goes around thinking, pondering about things, you know, talking to people. And they were looking for teachers, they were debating with each other, they were practicing all sorts of things, all sorts of very weird practices, some of them. You know, they'd sort of specialise in strange practices like holding your arm up in the air, or holding your breath, or starving yourself. Or doing very elaborate forms of meditation and so on. And amongst the wanderers, there was one new religion starting, which was called Jainism. And Jainism was founded by Mahavira. And he did something quite unusual, which is that he formed an order of nuns, a women's order although unfortunately many of the Jains denied the possibility of women gaining enlightenment. And it's around this time, or slightly later, while Mahavira was still alive, that the Buddha started his teaching career. And he launched his two great legacies. One of his great legacies was the Dharma, a system of training towards awakening, a system of teachings and methods and so on. And the other great legacy of the Buddha was the Sangha, a spiritual network of people cooperating with each other, trying to follow the Dharma. And against the old-fashioned ideas of the time, his Sangha included women from the very early stage. In fact, you could argue his very first disciple was a woman. But when he formed an order of full-time, homeless, celibate wanderers, the bhikkhus, it seems that then he was reluctant to also form an order for women. Having said that, it does seem that some of his early women full-time disciples were actually wanderers. The situation is not quite as clear-cut as it looks at first, so there are people who are living as bhikkhunis right from the very beginning. Probably before he'd set up a systematic order of bhikkhus with all their rules and their ordination procedure and so on. So what we have coming down to us after 2,500 years is a story of how the women's order did actually start. It's very difficult to tell how much of this story is historical fact. Some of it may have been invented later. Some misogynist elements may have been interpolated by some of the monks later. Anyway, this is what we are told about the formation of the Bhikkhuni Sangha. The Bhikkhuni is the Pali word for what we call a nun. So about 5 years after the Buddha's enlightenment, and his teaching career was 40 years, so quite fairly early on in his career, the Buddha's foster mother, Prajapati, and she'd brought him up after his mother had died when he was very small, so she was very, very close to him, of course. And she was very keen to become a homeless wanderer and a disciple of the Buddha, like the monks, and a number of her friends and colleagues were also interested in doing this. But when she asked, the Buddha said, no, he refused. So she gathered together all the women she could find who wanted to become bhikkhunis, nuns, and they went on this sort of a march. And they dressed themselves in robes, the kind of robes stained with earth that the monks, the bhikkhus, used to wear. And they marched up to the Buddha, and she asked him again. And he continued to be reluctant. But his friend and his attendant, Ananda, and cousin, asked him, well, are women capable of gaining enlightenment? He said, of course women are capable of gaining enlightenment. In fact, they went through, you know, are they capable of gaining this, this, this? And the Buddha said, yeah, of course, yeah, all of these, yeah. Indeed they are. And he was persuaded to change his mind. So he allowed an order of nuns to form. However, he subordinated the nuns to the monks. Monks always had to be involved in nuns' ordinations, for example, as well as nuns. The nuns had to defer to the monks, and at first they had to confess any transgressions of the bhikkhuni rules to monks as well as to nuns. Now, Prajapati decided, in fact, she said she happily accepted these special rules, and so as a result, many women were ordained, and the bhikkhuni order started, and they all left their homes to live a celibate life. I just want to remind you, by the way, though, that these were not the only people who were following Buddhism. These are the ones who were left home to live a celibate life. There were already many men and women who were practicing Buddhism without leaving home. So after a little while, Prajapati got fed up with having to defer to the monks, quite understandably. And she went back to the Buddha and said, come on, son. could you just change that rule? It's stupid. And he said, no, I'm not going to. He refused. And what he said was, in the same way that a household mainly consisting in women is in greater danger from robbers than one with plenty of men, he wanted to safeguard his order by having it dominated by men. And he wanted, he doesn't really explain what the problem was, actually, he just says this. He says that there would be a danger. But I think it's fair to say that this male domination has been the case in most periods of Buddhist history. And this seems very strange to us today, I think. It's so difficult to consider this issue in an open way. Would it be a problem if monastic Buddhism was dominated by women instead of men? Would it even be an advantage if it was dominated by women rather than men? And I would be interested to know what you think about that at the end of the talk. Now, it is very interesting that when Sangharakshita founded the Triratna order, the order that runs this centre here and that we are members of, he decided not to follow the Buddha's example. He gave an equal ordination to both men and women. He instituted one order rather than two, and he didn't institute any mechanism that ensures that men will remain dominant. However, it's important to see that he was also untraditional in another respect as well, which is that the order he founded is not monastic. So it's not directly comparable. It's not composed of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, monks and nuns. You don't have to be celibate to be an order member. And maybe that's a factor in the whole thing as well. And I do want to say more about celibacy later and what that's about. So what we had in the monastic order, in the traditional monastic order, was two separate orders, one for men and one for women, although they do interact. And when they do interact, the men are allowed to be dominant. But in general, they conduct their affairs separately. And I mentioned at the beginning that women had to confess any breaches of the rules to both men and women. But after a while, this rule was changed, and confession just happened within the men's sangha for men or within the women's community for women. So I mentioned the Triratna order is a single order. Though quite often, men and women order members will meet separately, or they'll have separate retreats. And nearly always, the preceptors who ordain women are women, and the preceptors who ordain men are men. So if we look at sexism in traditional Buddhism and in the Pali Canon, the earliest Buddhist texts, and what it says on women, the most important conclusion for me is that the Buddha agreed with the nun Soma in her what she said when she defeated Mara. Gender has no bearing at all on enlightenment. It's not a spiritual issue. And this itself is perhaps controversial in a way, in that some people will feel that there is a special women's spirituality and a special men's spirituality. And I would be interested to see what you think about that as well. Now, there may, of course, be some differences in what men and women most benefit from, different circumstances. But according to traditional Buddhism, there isn't a separate men's and women's spirituality. The principles are the same, because we're all self-aware human beings with the same kind of human mind. And so the issues we have to face are the same. The path we have to follow is the same. There's an excellent book called Sakyadita, Daughters of the Buddha. And the editor of this book is Karma Lekshik Tsomo. She's a Western Buddhist nun. I'm not sure if she's American or European. And she says, spiritual development is essentially an individual affair. Institutions may limit women's participation in the outer sphere, but no one can limit their inner development. But nevertheless, the Buddha did make these institutional differences that I've mentioned in the institution of the monastic Sangha. And these differences probably seem unfair to us now. However, if you look back into the context of the Buddha's time, it was actually a wonderful innovation for women, offering them this possibility, even though there was the downside of the deference to the bhikkhus. At last, they could escape from the constrictions of their family lives if they wished to, and be pretty much independent women, pursuing their own spiritual practice, forming their own communities, and so on. And indeed, several of the most prominent spiritual teachers during the Buddha's lifetime were women, and their pupils and disciples were both men and women. The women were teaching men. And again, this was very unusual for those days and for traditional societies in general, I think. They were involved in the spread of Buddhism. They were involved in the development and the exploration and the teaching of the Dharma. And it's even sometimes suggested that one of the Buddha's women disciples played a very important role in clarifying the whole area of conditionality, pratityasamutpada, which is the most important philosophical principle in Buddhism, and her name was Dharmadina. And those women who chose to continue living with their families also played an important and sometimes very outspoken role in the development of Buddhism. And I'm not an expert on the history of religions, but I was thinking of, at least if you think of the Bible, how many women are there in the Bible who are actually playing an important spiritual role, who are prophets or teachers or whatever? And I'm not sure that I can actually think of any if I think through it. So we've seen that spirituality is the same for women and men, according to early Buddhism. And the differences were differences in how the institutions were set up, not in how men and women were regarded. However, we do see two forms of sexism in early Buddhism, which persist to this day. The first form of sexism seems to be the classic antagonistic feeling that some religious men have towards women. And I'm not including the Buddha in that, but particularly after the time of the Buddha, from some of the monks, tending to put women down, tending to be rather afraid of them. And in some Buddhist countries, this attitude became stronger after the time of the Buddha, and the conservative views of male dominance were transferred from the societies where Buddhism travelled into Buddhism itself. So some of the conservative views, for example, of Imperial China infected the Sangha in China. The second form of sexism, in my opinion, is not really sexism, although it looks like it at first. There are a number of texts in which monks are told to regard women as unclean, unattractive, dangerous, and manipulative, which sounds really terrible. But you will also find texts in which women, celibate disciples, are encouraged to regard men as unclean, unattractive, dangerous, and manipulative. So you can probably see what's going on here. It seems rather extreme, but it's simply an attempt to help these often very young, celibate men and women to dedicate themselves to their practice and to deal with the temptations. There must have been many temptations to break their vows of celibacy and get involved romantically with members of the opposite sex. Now, it's quite often said in traditional Buddhist texts that it is a disadvantage being a woman. And I wanted to say a little bit about this. So, for example, in a poem of good wishes towards people practicing Buddhism, Shantideva, who is an Indian Buddhist teacher more than 1,000 years ago, he says he hopes that all women will be able to become men in future lives. And he regards this as being a very nice thing to say to people. I hope you'll manage to be a man in a future life. He doesn't actually explain why. He just takes it for granted that that's what people would prefer. Now, I suppose if you do encounter a lot of prejudice, you could say it's better to be a man than a woman because of that prejudice you've got to encounter. But apart from prejudice, the Buddha did also list five specific disadvantages in being a woman. And I'd be very interested to see what you think about these. So these are them. A woman has to leave her relatives when she joins her husband's family. That's the first one. The second one, she has to suffer menstruation. The third one, she has to suffer during pregnancy. The fourth one, she has to suffer during childbirth and child rearing. And then finally, it just simply says, she waits upon a man. So these are the five that the Buddha lists. Now, three of these are, as it were, biological, aren't they? They're to do with what happens to do with the reproductive organs. And two of them are not biological. They're definitely cultural, aren't they? They're definitely to do with social matters. And even though these are socially conditioned, it seems to me, at least until very recently, we had our own versions of both of them. A woman would be expected to sacrifice her own aspirations for the sake of her husband's career and ambitions, and also be subject to him in some respects. So although it wasn't quite the same as in ancient India, what would happen is when you got married, the man would stay in his own parents' home, and the woman would have to leave her parents' home and join him. And this was could cause a lot of suffering. There are stories, actually, of great problems of women having to move into a strange household, big households, and being not treated very well because they're probably the youngest adult member of the household when they got married. So these views of women are present, of the being, particularly the being disadvantages in being a woman, are definitely present in traditional Buddhism. And they go up to today. And even in Triratna, Sangharakshita, who founds it, and some other prominent people in Triratna have said that they feel it's more difficult for women to get the level of commitment in spiritual life than for men. And I would be interested to see what you think about that as well. A very controversial thing to say, it seems to me. However, if you are an independent celibate woman, like one of the Buddhist nuns, only one of those five issues is actually going to affect you, of course, that is menstruation. Nonetheless, for many women as well as men, it must have been a very hard decision to renounce the possibility of having children and a family in order to lead a full-time spiritual life. And what many women did, quite reasonably, was to make that decision after their children had grown up. And that's when they would go off and become nuns. And it's often also the case amongst Western women practicing Buddhism that they will adopt a more full-time spiritual life after their children have left home. And is that still a bigger issue for women than for men nowadays? Because it's an issue for men as well, of course. Karma Lekshe Tsomo, who I mentioned before, the Western Tibetan nun, she decided on the celibate option. And she's very grateful to the Buddha for setting up a celibate order for women. And she says, out of compassion, the Buddha created an alternative community for women which freed them from familial, that is, family constraints, and encouraged their spiritual pursuits. And she says that childbearing reduces one's options in life. The major disadvantage of a female rebirth, she says, is vulnerability to pregnancy and the responsibilities of parenting, which falls largely on the mother. And she feels that this means that, like her, she's a very dedicated meditator. She wants to meditate many hours a day. But for 15 or 20 years, that limits the amount of meditation practice you can do. As she concludes, ordination is even more advantageous for women than for men. Asian Buddhist nuns are well aware of this, and they candidly say, we're so lucky to be nuns, we don't have to have babies. So the Buddha lists these disadvantages, including pregnancy, childbirth, the restrictions of married life. But what he doesn't list is the disadvantages in being a man. So that would be an interesting thing to think about. What are the comparable disadvantages in being in the male gender, you know? Now, we saw that when Kisagotami sent Mara packing, she told him that gender has no bearing on spiritual practice. Nevertheless, we do see this thing of some Buddhists believing that it's preferable to be a man. And this debate seems to have been a live issue in many Buddhist societies. So once, for example, a man came to see the Buddha with his new baby girl, and he was lamenting. You say, oh, I really wanted a boy, and I've had a bloody girl, you know, and he's really upset about this. And the Buddha said, no, in many ways it's better to have a daughter than a son. Incidentally, I discovered that this is quite a famous little story. And the girl was called Srimala, and she became Queen Srimala, because she was born into a royal family. And she's the subject of one of the most feminist of the Mahayana sutras, the Lion's Roar of Queen Srimala. I don't know if that's related to the Buddha's pronouncement over her when she was small. And later, quite a number of these Mahayana sutras feature impressive, enlightened females. And I say females rather than women because some of them are not women, they're goddesses. or sometimes they're princesses of the dragon people or something like that. And in one case, Shariputra, who's a rather thick monk disciple of the Buddha, at least in the context he's rather thick, he asks one of them why on earth she'd not been reborn as a man, given that her spiritual attainment is so high. And she doesn't actually answer him in words. She simply, sort of like, a bit like fairy godmother, waves a little magic wand over him. And he finds himself in her body, and she occupies his body. So they've swapped gender, you know, much to his dismay. And this changing of sex that she does with him is to demonstrate that gender has no fixed existence. And she says to him, she says, "You talk about being a woman, but I have sought femaleness for 12 years, and I haven't found it." And she emphasizes that being male or female is only a matter of appearances and convention. There's no need to transcend femaleness to reach spiritual excellence, nor is there any need to be attached to femaleness, she says. And also, in the Tibetan tradition, you'll find the enlightened female bodhisattva Tara. I don't know if we have a picture of Tara in here. Oh yes, there's Tara there. So there's the enlightened female bodhisattva, Tara. And in one story, she's advised that she would have been better. "You would have been better to have taken the form of a man," Sally said to her. But she replies, "There is no such thing as a man, a woman, a self, or a person." And she took a vow to remain female in all her lives as a bodhisattva because of the scarcity of female teachers and role models. So that's a tradition about the mythical figure of Tara, that she took a vow not to be tempted to become a man. But this is going on, you know, into Tibetan Buddhism, but even going right back to the time of the Buddha in the very early teachings, this question of identifying with one's gender too strongly is discussed. And once the Buddha said that, he brought some people together, he said, "I want to talk to you about bondage and lack of bondage." And this is what he says. "A man attends inwardly to his masculine faculties, his masculine gestures, his masculine manners, his masculine poise, his masculine desires, his masculine voice, his masculine charms. He's excited by that. He's delighted by that. Being excited and delighted by that, he attends outwardly to feminine faculties, feminine gestures, manners, poise, desires, voices, and charms. He's excited by that and delighted by that. Being excited and delighted by that, he wants to be bonded to what is outside of him. He wants whatever pleasure and happiness that arise based on that bond. Delighting, caught up in his masculinity, a man goes into bondage with reference to women. This is how a man does not transcend his masculinity." And then he says exactly the same thing about women. So he says a woman attends inwardly to her feminine faculties, her feminine gestures, da, 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 all that sort of stuff. And then being excited by that, she attends outwardly to masculine faculties, gestures, manners, poise, desires, and so on. And she is excited by that and delighted by it. And so she wants to be bonded to what is outside herself. She wants whatever pleasure and happiness arise on the basis of that bond. And delighting, caught up in her femininity, a woman goes into bondage with reference to men. This is how a woman does not transcend her femininity. But if you don't want to get bonded to what's outside you, and to derive your satisfaction from that bond, then you need to try not to get caught up in your masculine or your feminine side, and not to get excited by the features of the opposite gender in other people. Thus, a man does not go into bondage with reference to women, and a woman does not go into bondage with reference to men. And each of them can transcend their masculinity or femininity. So sorry, that's a bit of a long bit, but it's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, quite insightful as well. It sounds like it was written by Carl Gustav Jung or somebody, doesn't it? So it's called the Sanyoga Sutra, which means the sutta of being bonded. So this issue of identifying too much with one's gender, which I'm sure to some extent we all have done, maybe occasionally. And I think that the difficulty of this represents the main advantage of single-sex activities. And this may seem strange, because you might think the best way to transcend your own gender would be, in a way, to ignore it and to mix freely between men and women and just enjoy that. But, and I think this definitely should be a part of one's experience, it would be dreadful to spend one's whole life with only one's own gender. But what do you think? Have you ever spent time just with women or just with men? Does that feel any different? And I think I find I can be more myself. I can forget about being a male, in a way, if I'm with my own gender. And this last weekend, as Arika was saying, we had a retreat at Dharmagiri, which was just for men. And one guy said he thought it was not in any way different from a mixed retreat. But some other people said that they really valued, you know, sometimes being with just men. So it's a matter of experience, I think. You try it and see how you find it. And I would be interested to know what you think about this. However, whether or not they use these single-sex activities, men also need to learn to relate to women simply as human beings. Women need to relate to men in the same way, don't you think? That's so important. And it sounds very straightforward and obvious, but it's more difficult than it seems. And one of the reasons, I think, is that we tend to sometimes shrink back into our own gender identity when we're with the opposite gender, unconsciously, almost as if we're playing a role. At least a lot of us, not everyone, but a lot of us. And sexual attraction may be a part of this, but that's only a part of this, although that can be an issue. And that's what I want to go into next, the issue of sexuality in Buddhism. So a lot of information here. I hope you're bearing up okay. Are you ready for having a look at sexuality as well? I'll assume that you are. So I wanted to start off by talking about celibacy. And the Buddha seems to have seen sex and sexuality as being a very big issue. Even a problem. And he offered one solution to it for those who are prepared to renounce family life, which I've already talked about, which is to join a celibate order of men or of women. And then you spend most of your time in single-sex situations. And when you're with members of the opposite sex, you're very, very careful, because you've taken a vow not to get sexually involved. And if you break that vow, you will be thrown out. That you won't just be told off, you'll be thrown out of the monastic order. And if you break it sort of in a full way, you can't be let back in again. You're thrown out for life. You know, so it's a big deal. You know, you can do some pretty awful things as a monk, and you can be readmitted. But not if you have penetrative sex. And the same goes for women, for nuns. Now, of course, that doesn't work so well, that idea of the value of being in a celibate order, if you're attracted primarily to members of your own gender. And I will come back to that later, because that's also an interesting and important issue. Some people say that the main reason that the Buddha asked his monks and nuns to be celibate was simply because he wanted them to be free to wander, to practice meditation, to teach the Dharma without any family responsibilities, keeping them in one place and keeping them with a requirement to sort of earn a living. So in those days, having sex meant almost certainly having children. So for the monks and nuns, sex is not an ethical issue. This is interesting. It's not an ethical issue, but it's an issue of defining the institution of the monastic sangha. It's a legal point, sex. I mean, there are reasons for it, but it's a legal point. So it is interesting that the defining instance where the Buddha instituted the rule, because the Buddha never instituted a rule for monks or nuns without something going wrong that made him decide, oh dear, we better have a rule about that, hadn't we? And in the rule, in the case where one of the monks went back to his former wife and slept with her, actually he was quite reluctant about it. It wasn't an issue of him being very unskillful. He was actually just trying to do it for the sake of his family, who was really keen. They really keen that that there was an heir to inherit the lands, you know. So he just did it as a favour, as far as he was concerned. So it wasn't an ethical issue; it was a legal issue. And of course, because there wasn't a rule at the time, he wasn't thrown out. He got away with it. So even if the sex involves no craving, it's still banned. And this is a point made by Janet Gatso in a recent survey of sex in Buddhism. And it's worth a read, this. It's an essay in a book called Critical Terms in Buddhism by Janet Gatso. And there is some really good scholarship around at the moment, I should say, particularly by women scholars in America, but some people elsewhere, on just trying to look at this whole area of both sexuality and gender in Buddhism. So if you're not a monk or a nun, it would be assumed that you would eventually find a partner and have children. And there's plenty of advice for people in that situation, and I'll come on to that later. But it's interesting that the Buddha strongly encouraged people, if they could, not to have a family. He was quite strong about this. He said, if you can, leave home, don't have a family. And this may be unique amongst the world religions, most of which encourage family life. And in fact, people are often shocked when they hear that the Buddha himself left home while his son was still a tiny baby. So in his case, he went celibate even when he did have a family. And I'd be interested to know what you think about that as well. Now, nowadays, things, of course, are different. Contraception means that you can be sexually active and still not have children if you don't want to have children. So does this mean that monastic celibacy is a thing of the past, is something that is only relevant to past times? And there is nowadays a new kind of Buddhist, and David Loy describes this new kind of Buddhist as less than monastic in lifestyle, but more devoted to practice than the laity have usually been. And David Loy is an American scholar, and he says that monasticism is not attractive to most Buddhists in America, but many are practicing very, very sincerely, much more so than traditionally the non-monks and the non-nuns would do in Buddhist countries. And in fact, this is the model that's been adopted by the Triratna order, which is described as being neither monastic nor lay. So, for example, I'm trying my best to be a full-time practitioner and teacher of Buddhism, and yet I do have a partner, and I'm glad to say that she's also very dedicated to her Buddhist practice. So I'm definitely not living like a celibate monk. But nevertheless, although there are these options nowadays, maybe we shouldn't write off monasticism too quickly. I mean, of course, it's not for everybody, but as an option, we shouldn't write it off. Because I'm not celibate, I definitely feel tensions that I wouldn't feel if I was celibate. You know, bonding together as a couple has such a strong pull. And in some ways, that call, that pull, can compete with one's attempts to have an open network of connections in the Sangha and to be one's own gender. So at the moment, I'm living alone, but part of me would love to set up a household with my partner. And if we'd been younger, I expect we would have considered having children. But yet another part of me would love to set up a men's community, since we haven't got one in West London where I live. And this is a tension, and there are a number of other similar tensions. And of course, if I gave up sex altogether, there would be other tensions, there would be different tensions, but those particular tensions at least wouldn't be there. But also, as well as tensions, there are potential negative difficulties in the Sangha if there are a lot of sexual relationships going on. I know in the past there have been difficulties here in Stockholm because of strong sexual relationships going wrong within the Sangha. Most Sanghas have been affected by this. And in the Triratna order, the founder of the order gave up being a celibate Buddhist monk and started to become sexually active. And perhaps inevitably his love affairs happened mainly with his own disciples. And this has caused some quite serious problems in the order, because it seems quite dangerous for a teacher to be sexually or romantically involved with his own disciples. On the other hand, and there always seems to be one key that goes back and forth like this, you know, there's always several sides to these arguments. There's a very interesting book by Miranda Shaw called Passionate Enlightenment, which is about women in tantric Buddhism. And she says that Tantric Buddhism does not take this particular view of relationships within the Sangha. Even in the early days of Tantric Buddhism, which started in India about 1,500 years ago, most practitioners found a sexual partner. They lived a simple village life, they made pilgrimages, and they meditated intensively. That was their Buddhist life. And she says, the seekers pursued a distinctive religious path that finds its most characteristic and nuanced expression in an intimate and sexual relationship. So a woman alongside a man is the ideal tantric pattern. And although tantric Buddhism became very popular in Tibetan monastic Buddhism, where they're being celibate, it could only get in there by sublimating the imagery and the practices, so that for the Tibetan monks and nuns, the sexual themes of tantric practice are just simply regarded as symbolic, which is not incorrect. They can be seen as symbolic, but they were also taken literally as well and practiced literally. But for some branches of tantra, actual sexual behaviour became a carefully regulated spiritual practice, which sounds rather exciting, doesn't it? But before you get too excited about this, I should say that usually it was very important not to come to a climax during sex, which sounds quite a tall order. And the man had to ensure that he did not ejaculate. So the intense pleasure, the idea of this was that you generated intense pleasure, intense longing and yearning, but you had to let go of it. And you saw that, like everything else, that had to dissolve into complete openness, into shunyata. So this is the way it became a spiritual path. And it needed the help of a teacher or a guru to help you do this in a way that worked. A difficult path. But this meant that the sexual energy was supposed to be sublimated into a spiritual energy. And this energy brings alive the subtle visionary body of the practitioner. You arouse intense sexual desire, and then you try to emulate the spacious calm of nirvana by not acting on that desire. Interesting, eh? Incidentally, while I'm on that book by Miranda Shaw, she says that the crucial role of women in the rise of tantric Buddhism has not been recognized until quite recently. And she says the reason for this is that the study, this is a quote, the study of other cultures continues to be undertaken from the perspective of providing documentation of the universality of oppression against women. So if they find one very strong spiritual culture where that oppression, where actually women were playing a major role in the development of the culture, of course that goes against that particular prejudice. And this prejudice, she suggests, is to legitimate current male dominance by saying, well, men have always oppressed women, so it's going to happen in the future, don't bother to try and change it. Tantric Buddhism shows a society in which women were not necessarily being oppressed. Anyway, so what if you are not a tantric Buddhist, you're not a monk or a nun, and this is probably most of us here, what about sex? What about your sexual ethics? Celibacy of monks and nuns is a rule, even a law, to preserve the institution. But if you're not a monastic, is it unskillful to have sex? Skillfulness, as you probably know, this is the word that applies to ethics in Buddhism. And it says that ethics itself is not a matter of rules and regulations. It's a matter of the mental states that your behavior comes from, and what effects your behaviour has on other people. That's how you tell whether something is skillful or unskillful. You try to make sure that you act from mental states of love, of clarity, stillness of mind, generosity, awareness, and that kind of thing. And you try to make sure that you bring benefit rather than harm to other people through your actions. That's the Buddhist definition of ethics. So how does sex fit in with this? Does sex benefit other people? Or is it entirely selfish? Can sex come from those skillful mental states? Or can it only come from longing or inner emptiness or frustration and craving? Well, traditional Buddhism definitely sees sex as a normal part of life, And so it tells you about skillful and unskillful sexual behavior. It does not say that all sexual behavior is unskillful. It says you can be either. And this is the role of the third precept of the five precepts. I undertake, as a part of my training, to abstain from sexual misconduct. And so what is this? Well, sex involving violence or coercion is obviously extreme sexual misconduct. But the most widespread kind of sexual misconduct, and the one referred to most frequently, is to endanger an existing relationship through your sexual behaviour. That is regarded as the most likely way in which any one of us might be tempted to break the third precept. And there isn't any condemnation of sex outside marriage. The problem is sex inside marriage when you're not the married person. That is the problem. And also, marriage, incidentally, does not mean having had a particular ceremony in a particular large building with pillars in it or anything like that. It means having made some kind of a commitment to another person. And that commitment can even be for one night. If you've committed to somebody for one night, then from the point of view of the third precept, you are married. And if somebody tries to come between you and seduce one of the two partners, they are breaking that precept. So remember that. Check very carefully before you start your seductive wiles. And the reason for this is because of the hurt and the confusion, of course, that you cause if you come between two people who've made a commitment to each other. The great Buddhist teacher Nagarjuna, who normally talks about very abstruse topics of wisdom and chunyata and so on, he says, the pleasure of husband and wife is to be two bodies but one flesh. To take away one who another loves and destroy this deep sentiment is a crime, he says. Anyway, it seems quite reasonable to me to look carefully at your sexual life and to see whether you can make it less self-centered and more considerate of your effect on others. And then your sexual life will be more ethical. But I want to come back again, though, to this issue of sex and unskillfulness, sex and negative mental states. A rather uncomfortable question. Is it possible to have sex without unskillful mental states being involved? Even if you're being very careful not to hurt the other person or a third party, can you have sex without unskillful mental states? Or is it primarily a selfish activity? And I'd be interested to know what you think about this. One of my favourite introductory books on Buddhism, which I really recommend, although it's difficult to get hold of, is called The Vision of Buddhism by Roger Corless, who's an American academic. And he says, sex is an all-consuming passion. When we're involved in it, our minds become muddy and confused. This precept warns us to watch out for the mental turbulence which often attends sex, and when in doubt, to refrain from the sex. And he goes on to suggest that ordinary life, with all its wants and fears, which is known as samsara in Buddhism, ordinary life is samsara, this is a drug that we are addicted to. We can easily mistake a samsaric phenomenon for a means of escaping samsara. Because it's fun, we think, oh, thank goodness, that'll take me out of all these problems I've got if I can just immerse myself in this enjoyment. And so we can bind ourselves to the decay, the disappearance, and the repetitive meaninglessness of the phenomenon itself. So perhaps sex can be rather like this. In fact, sex is traditionally seen in Buddhism as being potentially very strongly addictive. The middle way is to ask how liable one is to become addicted to sex if one indulges in it, remembering that a part of the addiction is denying that we are addicted. So just because you say, no, I'm not addicted at all, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not. So strong self-interest and overpowering craving are the things to look out for in your sexual life, it seems to me, or in your lack of sexual life as well. Of course, that's where it comes in, where you're not getting enough. And this is Roger Corless. But I think that even Roger Corless's view doesn't really go far enough, because sex isn't just about a particular activity, the rather slightly messy and potentially addictive things that go on under the bedclothers. It's also about bonding together with another person in a romantic couple relationship. And nowadays, we tend to see sex as necessary for happiness. We expect personal fulfillment through romance and sexual intimacy, at least, you know, in a certain age band anyway. And Buddhism questions this expectation. It's very hard, actually, to consider the possibility that sex is mainly an appetite driven by biology, not a marvelous and sacred thing. So because my bond with my partner feels unique, it sort of floats me above my sense of isolation, the isolation that so many of us feel, or it seems to anyway. But then very often, eventually, the relationship is not as satisfying, not as fulfilling as we expect. And when it goes wrong, we become very bitter and disillusioned. So, in fact, nobody else can make us feel complete. That's what the mistake we're making, thinking that another person can heal that sense of incompleteness. And at least according to traditional Buddhism, they cannot do it. We can only do it for ourselves. David Loy, who I mentioned before, calls romance a delusive cycle of infatuation and disappointment followed by a different infatuation. It's a slightly bleak view of it, isn't it? But I'll read it. Romance is a delusive cycle of infatuation and disappointment followed by a different infatuation. And this different infatuation is where we start looking again for the right person. Oh dear, I made a mistake. It wasn't the right person after all. I'd better try again. Now, of course, committed relationships can be a great joy. I'm not saying they can't. But it's important not to expect what they cannot give. They cannot fill our sense of lack. But I do believe that the Buddhist path shows how it is possible to fill that sense of lack in a far more effective way. Now, exactly the same points about unskillful sex and the dangers of romantic relationships also apply to homosexual sex. As far as I can see, early Buddhism doesn't see anything wrong with sexual attraction within one's own gender. Having said that, very highly sexed gay men sometimes tried to join the Bhikkhu Sangha in early Buddhism and caused a lot of trouble because they were joining for the wrong reasons, as you may be able to imagine. They thought, oh, we're onto a good thing here, aren't we? and so there were rules set up to try and stop that from happening. Anyway, but apart from that, early Buddhism doesn't seem to say there's any particular problem with homosexual attraction and behavior. But later on, different Buddhist schools took different approaches. Some of them were much more open and liberal than others. So the Dalai Lama school of Tibetan Buddhism, which is Gelugpa, at least in theory, was rather intolerant of homosexuality. But the Dalai Lama himself is an interesting guy because he's very open-minded and open to discussion, happy to talk things through with other people. And so deputations of gay men and women have been to see the Dalai Lama to talk this through, and he feels that his school should relax its position. But he does say, well, I've got to persuade everybody else, you know, so he's not actually done it yet, at least I don't think so. But I'll give the last word to Karma Lekshe Tsomo, the Western Tibetan nun who I mentioned earlier. She was the one who had no regrets about giving up sex. And she loves being a celibate. And she says, it avoids the cycle of clinging and unfulfilled expectation and the pain of separation in relationships, where often the longing for a companion is a wish to complement one's missing or undeveloped qualities. Celibacy, on the other hand, she says, represents the decision to rely on one's own inner authority. It's an attempt to achieve a balance and a wholeness within. It's independent of the feedback of another person, and it enables one to go beyond sexual attachment, which is the major force that propels beings from one rebirth to the next. Well, that's what she says. I'm not quite convinced yet, myself. Do you think it would be all right for me to put off becoming celibate until I'm maybe too old anyway to have any interest in sex?